Now for who then? One, I think we should maybe start. Thank you very much for coming to those in the room and those who are online. It's a very great pleasure to welcome, as one of the community directors of the Cambridge Family Law Center, it's a great pleasure to welcome Maithena Arakistan Ariola from the University of the Basque Country. It's been a particular pleasure that she's been visiting both the Cambridge Family Law Center here at the faculty and also at Robinson College at Granville. And I think it's particularly appropriate that you're going to talk on this particular topic today because there are plenty of comparative insights at a time when this very question is very much the subject of debate in England and Wales, as well as in your home country. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand over you to you to give your presentation on child contact, gender-based violence.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to begin by thanking the Cambridge Family Law Center for the opportunity to be here as a visiting fellow, and in particular, Professor Brian Sloan for hosting me and for organizing this seminar. Right, the topic I've chosen for today, disputed contact arrangements in cases of gender-based violence, is one that has generated a fair amount of debate in Spain, and which I thought would be of interest to you, precisely as Professor Sloan says, because it touches upon the question of the presumption of parental involvement, which is currently undergoing reform in your jurisdiction. So what I propose to do in the next 30 or so minutes is to give you an overview of how Spain regulates contact in cases of gender-based violence, and then take a look at how the courts are actually applying that legislation. And one of the challenges of comparing different legal systems or trying to explain one's own in a different language is that often terms like child arrangements or contact don't have the same legal implications under Spanish law as they may do under English law. And indeed, concepts like domestic violence or gender-based violence are close to your domestic abuse, but they're not quite the same. So I thought I'd spend a couple of minutes just clarifying a few terms. In Spain, like in England, when a divorce is, or a separation indeed, is contested, the court gets to decide who the child will live with. And we still refer to this as custody. And when custody is awarded exclusively to one parent, we talk about sole custody. And if it's awarded to both, we talk about joint custody. And when sole custody is awarded to one of the parents, the court has to determine what rights to contact the non-resident parent will have. In that sense, the Spanish law differentiates between the right to communicate, which would be indirect contact, the right to visit, which means direct contact, but generally without overnight stays, or right to stay, which refers to longer periods of contact with obviously overnight stay. So basically, in practical terms, this means that the courts have the opportunity to order varying degrees of contact, direct or indirect, and it works very similarly to your child contact arrangements with a right to the order to spending time orders and having contact orders. Right, the other two terms that I think is worth clarifying are domestic violence and gender-based violence. Under Spanish law, domestic violence refers to any kind of physical or psychological violence that occurs within the home or the family group, regardless of who is the perpetrator and who is the victim. So it would include violence against children or grandparents, or violence in a same-sex relationship, or of course, violence perpetrated by a woman against her female or male partner. By contrast, when we talk about gender-based violence, we refer exclusively to violence perpetrated by a man against his current or former female partner as a function of the structural imbalances or power inequality that exists between men and women. And it could include any kind of physical, psychological, sexual or economic violence, as well as controlling behavior or coercive behavior. And since 2022, it also includes any conduct directed at the mother to harm the mother through her children. So any behavior and designed to harm her through her children. So what we would call vicarious violence, because it is established, as you know, that when a man perpetrates acts of violence against his female partner during a relationship, chances are that when that relationship breaks down, he will try to continue to harm her or control her through her children. And sadly, that often happens during contact. Right, so over the past two decades, Spain has developed a comprehensive body of legislation designed to protect women and children from gender-based violence. And I think it's fair to say that today is considered as one of the pioneers in that field. This regulatory framework is directed not only at prosecuting the offender, but at eliminating all forms of violence against women. And this is the result of a political decision that was taken in the late 1990s, beginning of the 2000s, to treat violence against women not as a private conflict between individuals, but as a societal problem. So gender-based violence is understood to be rooted in the wider structures of the patriarchy and power imbalance between men and women. And therefore, the aim of the legislation is not only to protect the individual victim, but to protect women as a group. Whether the violence gets classified as domestic or gender-based is actually highly significant, because it triggers different procedural pathways, including access to special courts on violence against women, faster procedures, specific restraining orders, and special protective orders for women. And the fact that we have special protection orders for women or special mechanisms to protect women is by and large supported by society, but it is true that there are those who think that differentiating between domestic violence and gender-based violence creates an asymmetry in the system that favors women over men. Right. Let me now very briefly explain how Spain has arrived at the current legal position, because I think some of the themes will be familiar to you as issues that have arisen in the Hahn report and other subsequent discussion papers. Right, in 2004, Spain enacted a landmark piece of legislation that incorporated into the Spanish legislation a comprehensive set of measures designed to prevent and ultimately eliminate violence against women. Let's call it the 2004 Act. And the 2004 Act was a game changer. It introduced a fundamental change in approach. From that moment on, Spain moved away from the idea that any violence that happened within the home was part of a uniform category of domestic violence. And instead, it recognized that violence against women was a distinct problem that required its own specific legal response. So initially, the 2004 Act looked almost exclusively at women, and children were considered indirect or ancillary victims of the violence directed at their mothers. But even then, the Act included a provision whereby when a father was charged with a gender-based violence offense, the court had the opportunity to suspend contact arrangements with the child. So if the court issued a protection order for the mother, in the same judgment, it could also order the suspension of contact arrangements with the child. However, the courts hardly ever used this power, because they tended to think that violence or the question of violence against women was largely irrelevant to the issue of contact with the child. So we fast forward to 2015, and the 2004 Act is amended to recognize children as direct victims of gender-based violence. And with this recognition came a tightening of the provisions of the Act. And from now on, whenever a father was charged with a gender-based violence offense, it had the obligation to address the issue of contact. They could no longer ignore it. And that meant that if they decided not to use their power to suspend contact, at least they had to say how that contact would take place. So what frequency, what location, if it had to be supported, if it had to be supervised, etc. And the reason they introduced this amendment was because there was a growing concern that the courts were just ignoring the question of contact whenever they dealt with offenses that had to do with or that involved gender-based violence. And the idea was that this way they would be forced to look at it. And in fact, if we look at judicial records back then, the courts were issuing or were suspending, sorry, the courts were suspending contact arrangements in fewer than 4% of the cases where they were issuing protection orders. So clearly there was a tendency to ignore the issue. However, this amendment proved insufficient to change judicial attitudes. The courts seemed reluctant, not to say resistant, to suspend contact between the father and the child. And they continued to prioritize the relationship with the father. And in fact, even when they initially ordered restricted contact, the aim was always to progress to what is still called or referred to as normalized contact, which generally means unsupervised and unrestricted. The courts tended to minimize the seriousness of the offense by relabeling it as parental conflict, thereby suggesting that there was fault on both sides. And if the children appeared reluctant or refused to engage in contact with the father, the courts tended to default to a narrative of maternal manipulation or parental alienation. And so we arrived at 2017. And in 2017, something really significant happened in Spain. A document called State Pact Against Gender-Based Violence was unanimously approved in both chambers of the Spanish Parliament. I can't tell you how rare that kind of unanimity is. And this document included more than 200 recommendations for measures to tackle gender-based violence. And with regard to child contact arrangements, they actually advocated for quite a radical reform. They recommended that whenever a child witnessed, experienced, or lived with gender-based violence, contact with the violent father should be automatically prohibited or suspended. Now, the significance of this statement can be overstated because it reflected a clear cross-party agreement that the traditional pro-contact culture needed a fundamental reframing. Clearly, it was necessary to dismantle the assumption that contact with the father was always in the best interest of the child, and there was a need to push the courts towards a more child-centered, safety-focused approach. This domestic shift was closely aligned with the recommendations of various UN monitoring bodies that had already highlighted the need for Spain to strengthen their safeguarding measures for children in cases of gender-based violence. And significantly, they had called for the Spanish judiciary to adopt a gender-sensitive methodology in its decision-making in order to eradicate the existing biases against women. So against this backdrop of international scrutiny and domestic consensus, in 2021, the Spanish legislature introduced the no-contact rule in cases of gender-based violence. Now let's take a look to see how this has worked. As I mentioned earlier, if in a disputed divorce or a separation, the courts order sole custody, the non-resident parent will generally be entitled to some degree of contact with the child. Now, there's some debate as to whether there is such a thing as a right to contact, and if there is, whose right is it? And the Constitutional Court in Spain has said that there is a right to contact and that it belongs to both the parent and the child. And that it is the manifestation of their familial bond, but it recognizes that its exercise is always subject to the best interest of the child. So even though it says that it's not a duty of the parents, but a right of the parents, it says that it will have to be exercised subject to the best interest of the child. The specific parameters of the contact arrangements, the location, the frequency, etc., are subject to the discretion of the court, who has to have regard to the best interest of the child as the primary consideration. And this, as you know, is a mandate that comes from the UN Convention on the Protection of the Rights of the Child, and it is fully incorporated into Spanish law. The courts also have to hear the child whenever possible before making the decision, and they also have to hear from the Ministerio Fiscal, which is the Spanish public authority charged with safeguarding the interest of the child. Therefore, the general rule, or if you like, the statutory presumption, is that the non-resident parent has a right to contact. This rule admits an exception where the court considers that contact would be detrimental to the interest of the child. In those cases, contact can be restricted or even suspended. And it would be cases like cases where there is a serious and persistent breach of parental duties, such as failure to meet maintenance obligations or a persistent breach of the terms of a contact arrangement order. Now, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier, In 2021, the Spanish legislature decided that that general rule had to be turned on its head in cases where there was gender-based violence, or indeed domestic violence. And therefore, currently, Spanish law, in cases of contested divorce or separation, states that no contact shall be ordered, and where contact is already in place, it shall be suspended in two situations. First, where a parent has been charged with domestic or gender-based violence, and second, even in the absence of criminal charges, where there are sufficient grounds for suspecting that such violence has occurred. Therefore, where there is domestic or gender-based violence, the general rule is no contact. However, despite the fact that this rule has been drafted as a mandatory provision, despite the fact that it is an outright prohibition, it does admit an exception. And the exception says that the court will be able to order contact if it can be shown that in the particular case, and despite the existence of violence, it can be shown that it is in the best interest of the child to have a relationship with the violent or presumed violent parent. In other words, for the exception to apply, or for the court to be able to order contact, it has to show that it is in the best interest of the child. And whenever the best interest of the child are engaged, the court is under a heightened duty to justify its reasoning or its decision with particular care. In this context, this would mean that the court would need to provide clear and detailed reasons to show how, in the particular case, and despite the violence, it is in the best interest of the child to have contact with the violent or presumed violent parent. And this consideration has to be, or this decision has to be taken by having regard to a list of factors that is set out in a statute and that works in a very similar way to your welfare checklist. And one of the factors that has to be weighed in the balance is the child's right to live in a safe family environment free from any form of violence. Now, when the no contact rule was first introduced, its legality was challenged on the basis that it is contrary to the Constitution to mandate the automatic prohibition or suspension of contact without having the opportunity to assess the best interest of the child on a case-by-case basis. The Constitutional Court looked at this and refuted the argument and confirmed the legality of the provision, but interestingly, not by defending the automatic prohibition or suspension of contact, but by arguing that actually, when taken as a whole, the provision provides for a case-by-case analysis of the best interest of the child. Now, personally, I can't see how that can possibly be the correct interpretation of the no-contact rule, particularly if we take into account the very clear direction set by Parliament in 2017. And in fact, that was the view also of three of the magistrates from the Constitutional Court who issued a supplementary judgment in which they agreed with the finding of legality, but they disagreed with the reasonings for it. And according to the supplementary judgment, the true intent of the no-contact rule is indeed to establish a mandatory prohibition or suspension of contact as a way of reflecting the fact that domestic or gender-based violence is inherently incompatible with the best interest of the child. Only safe contact can be in the best interest of the child. And therefore, whenever there is evidence of domestic or gender-based violence, the precautionary principle dictates that contact has to be prohibited or suspended. And only if it can be proven that it is possible, despite the violence, to provide for safe contact that is in the interest of the child, that rule, that general rule, can be exempt. In any event, and under either of the interpretations put forward by the Constitutional Court, the fact that there is an exception to the general rule of no contact provides for a gateway through which the traditional pro-contact assumptions can re-enter the analysis. And therefore, there is a very big risk that the courts may just choose to use the exception as a way of falling back to doing what they've always done, which is assume that contact is safe unless the contrary can be shown. Instead of doing what the law now requires them to do, which is start from the opposite assumption that whenever there is any evidence of gender or domestic violence, contact with a violent parent, assumed violent parent, is not in the interest of the child. This is actually a pretty fundamental shift because it puts the child's safety front and center. And crucially, it moves the burden of proof away from the victim and onto the perpetrator. By changing the starting point from assuming contact to assuming no contact, the legislature is not just tweaking with the different factors that the court has to look at, but it's actually trying to force a change in what is a deeply ingrained and entrenched judicial attitudes. So, has it worked? Well, it's only been 5 years since the change was implemented, and given the magnitude of what it's trying to achieve, it's probably too early to say one way or another, but still we can look at the evidence we have so far. The judiciary's own data shows that the number of cases where contact is suspended following a protection order is still small. Remember I said that before 2015, contact was being suspended in about 4% of the cases where a protection order was issued. Well, that figure for 2025 is 13%, so it's better, but it's obviously still very low, because it means that in 87% of the cases where a court considered that there is sufficient evidence, sufficient risk for the woman so that they are justified in issuing a protection order, they still don't think that it is necessary to suspend contact arrangements with the child. Still, it's a 10-point improvement from 2020, the year before the no-contact rule was introduced, when contact was awarded in 97% of those cases. So perhaps that's an indication that the change in emphasis is beginning to work. There is other evidence, however, that suggests that we're still a long way from any meaningful change. A report was issued last year on the way in which civil courts handle family law cases where there is gender-based violence. And it looked at all the relevant decisions issued in 2022 and 2023, so post no contact rule. And they found that contact was being suspended in fewer than 17% of the cases. But even more worryingly, they found that out of all these judgments, only 30% of them actually acknowledge the existence of gender-based violence. And when we consider that the study only looked at cases where there was evidence of gender violence, the fact that 7 out of 10 judgments didn't even mention it is deeply concerning. And obviously it's a clear indication that they didn't take into account the violence when they ordered the contact arrangements with the child. Instead, the report shows that there is a tendency to talk about parental conflict instead of acknowledging the existence of gender-based violence, which in turn makes it easier to suggest that there is fault on both sides, that this is a problem between the parents, between the adults, that should not prevent the child or deprive the child of his right or her right to have a relationship with his or her father. And the report shows that for this conviction, because it is a conviction, there isn't necessarily a lot of evidence behind this statement, for this conviction to be overturned, the amount of evidence of gender-based violence has to be overwhelming. Another prevalent argument is that the father was never violent towards the child, but only towards the mother. And this argument often comes accompanied by a characterization of the mother as manipulative and by claims of parental alienation. The mother is also often described as revengeful or unwilling to adopt a positive parenting style that would facilitate contact with the father. And by contrast, her status as victim of gender-based violence is rarely mentioned in these judgments. Another problem is the use of general statements to justify that contact with the father is in the best interest of the child. I mentioned earlier that whenever the best interests of the child are engaged, the courts are under a heightened duty to provide or give particularly detailed and clear reasons for their judgments. So general statements are an absolute no-no. They're still very prevalent, and one of the most prevalent general statements is to say that contact is essential to preserve family bonds. And therefore, if contact between the father and the child is suspended, then there is a risk that that bond will be broken and it may become irrecoverable. Whilst as a general statement, this may well be true, it tells us absolutely nothing about the best interest of the child in the particular case, particularly when there is gender-based violence. So I'm conscious that I've just painted a rather bleak picture of the current situation, but there are some encouraging signs emerging from Spain's two highest courts, the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court. In the last 2 years, the Constitutional Court has issued three very significant judgments in which it develops the line of thinking set out in the supplementary judgment that I mentioned earlier. And in all three cases, the main proceedings involved a claim filed by the father against the mother for failing to comply with the terms of a contact arrangements order. And in all three cases, the mother argues that in order for her behavior to be properly understood and that of the child when he or she refuses to engage in contact with the father, it is necessary for the court to consider the context of gender-based violence, which, according to the mothers, the courts have failed to do. The Constitutional Court agreed with the mother in each of the cases and made some important statements. It said that where gender-based violence is alleged or suspected, the courts must address it explicitly in its judgment, i.e. they can't ignore it or continue to ignore it, and they have to explain how the competing rights have been balanced. They also have to avoid gender stereotypes in their reasoning, and they have to look for patterns of abuse and not look at specific incidents of violence. The Constitutional Court also reminded the ordinary courts that the no-contact rule is compulsory and not discretionary, because they needed reminding. And they must adopt a child-focused approach guided by the precautionary principle. And this is important. The safety of the child has to be front and center and not the rights of the parents. Turning then to the Supreme Court, again, we're beginning to see judgments where the Supreme Court has corrected the lower courts in line with the no-contact rule and the guidance of the Constitutional Court. It is still early days, and therefore there are only a handful of judgments, but they're beginning to emerge. And this is significant because hopefully this will encourage more women to appeal the judgments of the lower courts. And hopefully this in turn should bring about the desired change in judicial attitudes. But however, in the meantime, having to go all the way to the Constitutional, well, first to the Supreme Court, and in some cases, even to the Constitutional Court, particularly when there is gender-based violence, is clearly not ideal. And it raises serious issues of access to justice. So to conclude, I think the no-contact rule has been a step in the right direction. And I think it has been a necessary step. And not because there was any gap in the legislation. There wasn't. The Spanish judiciary has had the power to suspend contact for years. But because something radical had to be done in order to compel the courts to change their attitude and to pivot towards a child-centered approach that gives due weight to the harmful effects gender-based violence has on children. At the very least, the no-contact rule should compel the courts or force them to consider the issue in more detail and develop a better understanding of the way in which this violence works. But as to whether it will be enough to change judicial attitudes, I think we will still have to wait for a few years before we can tell one way or another. And in the meantime, I will be watching with interest to see what impact, if any, the removal of the presumption of parental involvement has on judicial outcomes in your jurisdiction. Thank you.